Blog Talk Radio.
Prefaces are not always that important.
We're going to skip the introduction as well, because although it's by Ruth Bell Graham, if you ever want to read it for yourself. I just want to get straight to the book at hand, if that's all right. Chapter 1. Me, Lord? Single? There was not much of a view from the window. The central feature was the garbage cans behind the dining hall. The closed windows shut out neither the tremendous crash and clatter of early morning collections nor the noisome effluvium of the day's cooking. Nevertheless, I was tickled pink to have that little room. It was a single one, what I had been waiting and finally got when I was a senior in college. It had a bed, a bureau, a bookcase, and in the corner by the window, a desk with a straight chair and a lamp. A place for solitude and silence, a closet of the sort Jesus said that we should go into to pray. I did my studying and some of my praying at that desk. There were maple trees and the old elm behind the garbage cans, and I was often distracted by the crowd, flock, skitter, of the squirrels that lived there. I watched them getting ready for winter, tearing up and down, frantically transporting provisions, scolding, chattering, flicking their tails. I watched the maple leaves change color and fall. Watched the rain pace them to the black driveway. I watched snow fall upon those trees and cans. It isn't hard at all to put myself back in the chair at that desk. When I sit at a different desk now and read letters from puzzled young people, I become that girl again who gazed out at the snow. What I wore was not very different from what they wear. Now, styles easily come in full circle in 35 years. Well, the only thing I can say so far is, boy, I don't know what you'd think about the styles today, because they sure are different than then. And for crying out loud, in the summertime, I see girls wearing shorts that are shorter than my boxers. It's terrible. But anyway, I had 2 skirts, 3 sweaters, and a few blouses, which I did my best to mix and match so that it looked as though I was wearing different outfits. Wednesdays were easy. Everybody in the senior class wore the same blue wool blazer with a college emblem sewn over the breast pocket. My hair gave me an awful time. It was blonde, had a hint of a bend in it, and grew about 1 inch a month. How easy it would have been to wear it hanging long and straight, but that was unthinkable then. My curls were all a put-up job. I could only afford 1 permanent a year. In between times, I relied on my old pin curl system, twirling strands of hair around my finger every night before I went to bed, securing them with a bobby pin. You know, so far this is anecdotal, and I have mixed thoughts about anecdotal stuff because sometimes, from my experience reading books like that, it's filler. But, you know, keep in mind, I'm a guy. I'm reading a book that's written by a woman. It's a female perspective. I imagine it takes a lot of work during that. So I'm sure she's leading to the punchline here in regards to that thought. If I couldn't do much with my hair, I could do less with my face. Like most girls, I wished I were pretty, but it seemed futile to tamper with much what I had been given. Beyond using a cautious touch of pale lipstick, something called Tangy, which cost 10 cents, and a pat of powder on my nose. I needed that tiny, cozy room that year, perhaps more than ever before. Some issues that would set the sail of my life were to be dealt with. During the preceding summer, I had finished praying about whether or not I was to be a missionary. I was, after what my Plymouth Brethren friends would call an exercise and what people would now call a struggle. It was clear at last. The struggle was not over any unwillingness to cross an ocean or to live under a thatched roof, but over whether this was my idea or God's, and whether I was meant to be a surgeon, I love dissecting things, or a linguist. I came to the conclusion that it was God who called, and the call was to linguistics. I asked for assurance from the Lord and got it. So that was that. But there was another matter of business, not by any means finished. This was one that, for which God knew I would need a closet. It was about being alone for the rest of my life. I was saying, "Me, Lord? Single?" It seemed to come up between me and my Greek textbooks when I sat at the desk, between me and my Bible when I tried to hear God speaking. It was an obstruction to my prayers and the subject of recurrent dreams. I talked often about this to God. I don't remember mentioning it to anybody else for many months. The two who shared the suite, of which my room was one-third, were not the wildly popular sort of whom I would have been envious. They were quiet, sensible girls, a few years older than I, one a music major who spent most of her time practicing the organ in a conservatory, the other a former WAVE, the women's branch of the Navy, who was an expert at knitting Argyle socks. Both of them, in fact, turned out countless pairs of socks and mittens and sent them off somewhere by parcel cost. "What you get a needle in your hand," Jean said to me one day, "you are just lost, aren't you?" Compared to those two, I was. After college, Jean married. Barbara is still single. I have no memory of any discussions with them on love and marriage, although we must have had some. But I am perfectly sure that for the three of us, singleness meant one thing: virginity. If you were single, you had not been in bed with any man. If you were to be permanently single, you were never going to be in bed with any man. Boy, have times changed. That was 100 years ago, of course, but even 100 years ago, anybody who quite seriously believed that and acted on it would have been seen as an oddity by many people. Perhaps we were in the minority. I can't be sure about that. Certainly the majority professed to believe that sexual activity was best limited to husbands and wives, whether or not their private lives demonstrated this conviction. Now, however, in the last few years of the 20th century, times have changed. They tell us for thousands of years society depended on some semblance of order in the matter of sex. A man took a wife or wives in some regularly prescribed manner and lived with her or them according to recognized rules. He messed around with other men's wives only to his peril. A woman knew that she possessed a priceless nature, her priceless treasure, her virginity. She guarded it jealously for a man who would pay a price for it. Commitment to marriage with her, and with her alone, even in societies where polygamy was allowed. Rules governed responsibilities to spouses, rules on which the whole stability of the society depended. Somehow we've gotten the idea that we can forget all the regulations and get away with it. Times have changed. We say we're liberated at last in our inhibitions. We have sex, the single girl now. It's nothing with her. It's just the way... I didn't even mean to say it that way. I'm sorry, but it just sounded terrible. Excuse me. We have sex and the single girl now. We have freedom. We can, in fact, have it all and not get hooked, supposedly. Women can be predators if they want to, as well as men. Men aren't men unless they proved it by seducing as many women as possible, or as many men. For we may now choose to live according to sexual preference. Boy, is that still true. It's probably even more true now than it is back in her day. It's, yeah, it's too bad. You know, that's actually one thing that I can definitely comment on in personal experience. You know, there's a lot of confusion I had when I was a kid. One thing I can definitely say from personal testimony is, for the longest time, I didn't know how I should be as a man. You know, I had a lot of people telling me to do certain things that made me a man, and one of the things that people told me was, and including my dad, was this idea of lust being not a big deal. You know, in particular, you know, a lot of guys acting like pornography is not a big deal, and acting like the more girlfriends you had, the cooler you were, and the more strong and in control you were as a man, and so on and so forth. Boy, is there a lot of bondage there. Yes, I'm sure there's a lot of pleasure. I, by the grace of God, was not granted permission to do much of the temptations that swirled in my head. If I was allowed some of the temptations in an alternate reality, I might be in prison right now. But thank the Lord... Thank the Lord that he didn't have me act on certain temptations, and thank the Lord that he didn't allow me to achieve certain things I wanted to do. he freed me from that. So that's definitely, from my experience, very true. We have a society that pushes both guys and girls to be that way. And it's very dangerous and very scary. Anyway. We can go to bed with those of the opposite sex or those of our own. It doesn't matter. A mere question of taste, and we all have a, quote, right, unquote, to our tastes. Everybody's equal. Everybody's free. Nobody is hung up anymore or needs to deny himself anything. In fact, nobody ought to deny himself anything he wants badly. It's dangerous. It's unhealthy. It's sick. If it feels good and you don't do it, you're paranoid. If it doesn't feel good and you do it, you're a misogynist. The reason my roommates and I believed that singleness was synonymous with virginity was not that we were college students 100 years ago, when everybody believed that. It was not that we didn't know any better. It was not that we were too naive to have heard that people have been committing adultery and fornication for millennia. It was not that we were not yet liberated or that we were just playing stupid. The reason is that we were Christians. We prized the sanctity of sex. I saw at that desk by the window and thought long and hard about marriage. I knew the kind of man I wanted. He had to be a man who prized virginity, his own as well as mine, as much as I did. What do women want today? What do men want? I mean, deep down, what do they really want? If times have supposedly changed, and have human longings changed too, how about principles? Have Christian principles changed? I say no to the last three questions, an empathetic no. I am convinced that the human heart hungers for constancy. In forfeiting the sanctity of sex by casual, non-discriminatory making out or sleeping around, we forfeit something we cannot do well without. There is a dullness, monotony, sheer boredom in all life when virginity and purity are no longer protected and prized. By trying to grab fulfillment everywhere, we find it nowhere. End of chapter 1. I think we got at least enough time to read chapter 2, possibly chapter 3, by the look of this. Chapter 2, The Life I Owe. A young British preacher named Stephen Olford spoke in our college chapel for a week. Two things he said stayed with me. He quoted from the Song of Solomon, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that ye stir not up, nor awake love until it please." He interpreted this to mean that no one, man or woman, should be agitated about the choice of a mate, but should be asleep, as it were, in the will of God, until it should please him to wake up. The other thing he urged was that we should keep a spiritual journal. I determined to follow his advice on both counts. I bought a small brown loose-leafed notebook, almost exactly the size of my small brown leather-bound Bible, given to me by my parents for Christmas in 1940. These I kept together at all times. I wrote on a fly leaf of the notebook the Greek words meaning, "For to me, to live is Christ." On the first page, I copied out one stanza of Annie R. Cousin's hymn, taken from the words of Samuel Rutherford. "O Christ, he is the fountain, the deep, sweet well of love. The streams of on earth I've tasted, more deep I'll drink above. There to an ocean fullness his mercy doth expand. His mercy, and glory dwelleth in Emmanuel's land." I'll have to look that up sometime. I called the notebook the Omer of Manna, taking the idea from Exodus 16:32, and Moses said, "This is a thing which the Lord commandeth. Fill an Omer of it to be kept for your generations, that they may see the bread wherewith I have fed you in the wilderness when I brought you forth from the land of Egypt." It's in context in regards to the manna they wanted in this box in order to show, hey, this was a real thing. This wasn't something we made up and here, you know, as proof kind of thing. So she's using this as a metaphor for expressing her thoughts. You know, that's something I have not really done that much. I mean, I've tried to, and then I kind of fell astray, was the idea of keeping a journal. It might not be a bad idea. One thing I think is interesting based on reading her perspective, even though she does have that anecdotal aspect to it, it's with good reason so far. It's not filler like some books would be. Like I noticed some books will just be like blah, 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 blah about their anecdotes, and there's like it's like, okay, I think you're just over dramatizing your point. Lord, what is love? God is love, and he that dwelleth in love dwelleth in God. 1 John 4:16. This is my commandment, that ye love one another as I loved you. John 15:12. Father, how is this possible? The love of God is shed abroad in our hearts by the Holy Ghost, which is given unto us, Romans 5:5. O love that wilt not let me go, I rest my weary soul in thee. I give thee back the life I owe, that in thine ocean depths its flow may richer, fuller be. George Matheson. I give thee back the love I owe. Owe? Why owe? It's my life, isn't it? Have you forgotten that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit who lives in you and is God's gift to you, that you are not the owner of your own body? You have been bought, and at a price. That's a verse that's a good response in regards to the abortion argument. Oh, it's my body, blah, blah, blah. Well, first of all, it's Christ's. But second of all, there's another body within that body. It's the baby's body, but I digress. That's a whole other rant. We're not going to do that. The sense of destiny. Someone has paid for me with blood. How the knowledge lifts my sights beyond the moment's hot desire. But now this is the word of the Lord, the word of your Creator, O Jacob, of him who fashioned you, Israel. Have no fear, for I have paid your ransom, I have called you by name, and you are my own. I have no idea what verse she's quoting. She doesn't cite the source for that one. There my destiny is defined to be created, fashioned, ransomed, called by name. What was true of Israel is true of the Christian who is called a child of Abraham by faith. When you pass through deep waters, I am with you. When you pass through rivers, they will not sweep you away. Walk through fire, and you will not be scorched. Through flames, and they will not burn you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Redeemer, or your Deliverer. A young woman came to me several years ago to ask, is it okay to tell God I'll be a missionary if he'll give me a husband? I said no. She had not yet understood his claims. Are we in a bargaining position with our Creator, Redeemer, the Holy One? It was no perishable stuff like gold or silver that bought your freedom from the empty folly of your traditional ways. The price was paid in precious blood, the blood of Christ. March 1st, 1948. So will not we go back from thee? Quicken us, and we will call upon thy name. Turn us again, O Lord, O God of hosts. Cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved. Psalm 80:18-19. On thy brow we see a thorn crown. Blood drops in thy track. O forbid that we should ever turn us back. Amy Carmichael, India. Lord, I have said the eternal yes, let me never, having put my hand to the plow, look back, made straight the way of the cross before me. Give love that there may be no room for a wayward thought or step. End of chapter 2. So, although it's not clear, just to pause for a second, I would say, based on what she has said so far for chapter 2, is she's making the point, number one, that for chapter one, that you, whether it be you as a woman or you as a guy, depending on who you are listening right now, you need to not do what the culture says. Culture says you can have sex with whoever, just about anybody, pretty much, whenever you want, however you want, whyever you want, just about. And Elizabeth Elliot is saying, no, if you are to be in Christ, you can't do that. You have to be willing to stay a virgin until you find that right guy to get married. Not only is it because the Bible is clear on that, but at the same time, she also says that what the culture does cheapens the idea of sex and makes it something that you it robs you out of the opportunity to really cherish that first moment, really cherish the idea of what sex is supposed to mean. It cheapens it when you do it the way the world does, and that's very true. You know, she seems very, like the type of woman who's very poetic in that she has certain ideals that certainly don't match up the way our society do, and it's unfortunate, but, you know, I respect that. And us guys need to respect that, too, because women are created in the image of God, you know. In fact, women were originally from man. Adam's rib that women were drawn from. Woman is from man in the Hebrew, I believe. That's the wording there. And then chapter 2, though, it's kind of vaguely poetic. I think what she's trying to say with that is we have to be willing to find somebody who loves us, but we have to understand that God loves us even more. And at the same time, it's the fact that if we love God, we'll be willing to put what he feels above what we might feel because of what he did for us on the cross. So the idea of being like, well, I don't know if I want to go through with what this Christian stuff says. She's saying, I think, well, you should, partially because of what Christ did for you on the cross. You know, he did a lot for you that you can never, ever repay back and that you can never truly appreciate deep down. But just trust him. Just stay confident. He loves you, and we're supposed to love him back. And we're supposed to find somebody who loves us as well like that. And, you know, so far I like that these chapters are really short. I'm not going to read chapter 3, even though I might be able to do it with a little, like, going over time, but I'm just going to stop there for now. But it's an interesting study. So far, I don't think it's as good as William Wilberforce's book that we did for the last few Thursdays is, but I mean, it's got potential. You know, it's interesting to see her perspective as a woman. You know, that's one of the things us guys don't always understand is when a woman's thinking. You know, we like to think that we know what we're talking about. We like to think that we're in control, but that's not always the case. You know, there's a reason why God created women the way that they are, and we need to not fall for what the mainstream culture tells us guys. We need to understand women are our souls, just like us guys, you know, in that aspect, but they're unique, just like we have unique differences. And us guys are tempted by the mainstream media to view them as sex-giving, sandwich-making dolls in some circles. They're supposed to look pretty, they're supposed to have certain talents, you know, and you know, I can understand to a degree on why the feminist movement started, because there are some guys back in, well, Elizabeth Elliot's days as a young girl, you know, she said she got her Bible in the year 1940, I think is what it said, and some of those girls couldn't cope with the challenge that God had given them. In order to, instead of looking for God to help and trusting in God's love and trusting in God's provision, they decided to do this feminist movement crap that we have today, unfortunately. The idea that women can be with women, the idea that they don't need no man and men are all dogs and blah, 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 blah. You know, in a way, you want to be angry about some of the stuff you hear on feminist mantra, and even offline with the different conferences and stuff that these women have. But at the same time, I feel more, after reading this, more pity. Because there's a lot of girls in that camp that are only doing this because deep down they're hurt. They know they don't match up to what society says about how they should be. And so instead of clinging to the cross of Christ, they reject it and do what they do. And I pity those girls. I really do, because a good chunk of those girls, from my experience back in the day, are beautiful girls. They're beautiful not on the inside, outside, but on the inside too. And Scott, we need to understand that, but we need to understand even more so what Christ does for us And that's kind of a little teaser that Elizabeth Elliot gives. That's all the time that we have for today. Be sure to tune in tomorrow when we look at our Bible study, continuing that, and then we'll do the Passion for Purity next Thursday again for part two. We should be at we did Genesis. So 1 Samuel chapters 11 through 15, at least as much of that as possible. So God bless you, and thank you for listening. And if you have any questions, comments, concerns, prayer requests, let me know. I'd love to have a conversation about what's been talked about so far and more conversations about in regards to this book to come. So until then, God bless you. Thank you for listening.